The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. It's Wednesday. We got 2 days left. Yay! In the year, I'm excited that 2021 is soon to be in the history books. I heard a great line last night. You know, I've been talking about 2021 as basically being a continuation of 2020. Well, we were watching some comedy thing, and I don't even remember who said it, but the line was very good. 2021, it's like a 2020 variant. It grew out of the infection that was already there. Anyway, so it is. It is a 2020 variant, and hopefully this too shall pass. Sooner rather than later, please. So I don't know where you are, but everybody has COVID. It seems that everybody has COVID. So just stay safe. We're back in like it was the beginning of the pandemic. I don't go out. Allison still hasn't been boosted yet, so she's not allowed to come over right now unless she's wearing a mask and we're outside. We're taking it that seriously because there are so many things we still don't know. It seems that the Omicron variant is less severe than Delta, but it's not only Omicron. I corrected the information that I've been giving in today's What's News, but basically the CDC revised their estimates of how prominent Omicron is right now, where last week they were saying it was like 73% of all infections are Omicron. Then they revised it downwards and said it was 40-something. Now they're saying it's 22%. And Delta still makes up 43% of the infections. And you know what? No matter how you look at it, it's deadly. Not only is COVID-19 highly infectious, and you know, if you are one of the people who gets the symptoms, it's not fun. You know, this week through today, I've been also guest hosting Brad Friedman's broadcast, and being that weird week between Christmas and New Year's, it's a tough time to even try to get guests on, to invite people on, because this is family time, you know? So Monday morning, I signed on to start my work for the day early in the morning, and I noticed a tweet from Marcy Wheeler. So I saw she was tweeting, and I thought, well, let me give it a shot. And I asked her, do you have any time at all this week? We could go live on my show. We could tape any time that works for you. And she said, you know, like taping in about an hour would be great. So we did. We taped it on Monday. And actually, I used it for today. I was going to use it for today all along. But I used it on Brad's show Monday night because it was that good. Marcy Wheeler is one of those people. She's just really smart. And she's laser focused. So she's over there in Ireland covering what's going on over here better than most American journalists who are already on U.S. soil do. Her blog, her website is emptywheel.net. And she has been doing a better job, in my opinion, of covering the aftermath of January 6th than anyone else. Look, we're just a week and a few days away from the first anniversary of that dreadful day, right? So the natural question at this point is what, if anything, has happened to all those people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. There's not a whole lot of information out there, and maybe it's because the trials have not actually yet begun. But there are hearings, mostly with plea deals. Over 700 people were arrested in the aftermath. And, well, you'll hear Marcy. She says about 100 or so have cut deals with the prosecutors. And each one of those doesn't have a trial, but they have a hearing. And she's been listening in. There's a number you can dial into. So she's been listening and covering it again, like nobody else. So that's what we're going to do for most of this hour is hear back from that interview. Now, I need to tell you one other thing. Earlier today, I had a thing online. I was contacted by somebody who I'll say now is a former listener. And it was somebody, I don't accept friend requests on Facebook anymore because I always hit the limit and I've got like more requests than I have room for people. But occasionally when it's somebody who I know it's a listener, I know it's somebody who participates in the chat room, I know it's somebody who's been around for a long time, I will accept the friend request. So that's what happened with this woman a few weeks ago. And so today she tried to call me using the Facebook Messenger thing. Don't do that. I don't take those calls. So anyway, I messaged her back and said, what's up? I don't take those calls. And she told me, I wonder if I can find the exact thing. I'm not going to give you the whole story today because it would take up too much time, but maybe tomorrow. So she said, I said to her, you know, I don't take these, those calls. I said, so what's up? She said, oh, I was just, sorry, we went back and forth for a long time. I was just wondering if you heard anything about the Department of Health and Human Services grants. And I'm like, no. She said, really? They're having promotional program to help citizens, both old, retired, disabled, and workers with cash, $150,000. I wonder if you got your money yet because I saw your name on the winner list. Well, this brought up all kinds of red flags. To make a long story short, this poor woman was scammed by some scammer on the internet. So I'll leave you with this for now, and then I'll tell you the whole story tomorrow. Don't give anybody on the internet any of your personal information. This woman gave this person, who's posing as a government agent, her name, her age, her social security number, her address, and more. Don't do that. She says she got $150,000 in cash delivered to her house today. Yeah, no, she didn't. She showed me a picture of some packets of money in a box that were $1 bills on the top. Well, if they were all singles, it would have weighed over 300 pounds. She didn't. And when I tried to explain to her she'd been scammed, she told me it was God's will taking care of her. And then she blocked me. So just a warning. Don't give out your personal information on the internet, please. My God, and we're trying to save you from COVID. Now I got to save you from internet scammers too? Please be careful. They're out there. They're out there to get you. Be skeptical. All right. With that, I want to get to Marcy Wheeler because or we're going to run out of time. So take it away, magic of videotape.
Thrilled to welcome back to the program Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist who writes about national security and civil liberties as Empty Wheel at emptywheel.net and occasionally other places as well. And these days doing it from Ireland. So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year and all that stuff. How are the holidays in Ireland?
There's less COVID here than there, so that's nice.
Wow. So things are better there. I befriended a family who lives in Kent in England. They sing. They're the Marsh family. In case you haven't heard of them, you should check them out on YouTube. They will delight you. Anyway, so I spoke with them last week and things are getting crazy there again, but they're better in Ireland.
We have one of the highest vaccination levels in Europe. Yeah, I mean, it's just people get vaccinated here. So, and people are a little more cautious, I think, than they are in other places. So, yeah, there's an upswing, but there's less of an upswing, I think, than in a lot of other places.
Well, I guess we take little positives wherever we can get them these days. It's just nuts here. You know, I'm in Florida, and our governor is more demented than ever. I mean, it's the opposite world nature of things is just crazy. But I was just on Twitter a little while ago. I saw you posted something and I thought, oh, let me check in with Marcy and see if she's available for a end of the year sort of roundup on where things are. Because at emptywheel.net, you more than anybody else that I've noticed have been covering the progress of the investigation by the committee, the Select Committee in the House, into January 6th, plus the prosecutions of the people who are arrested, although we still haven't seen any trials yet. What's happening are still all the plea deals that people are taking? What's going on in the courts for the January 6th defendants?
If you want to start there, we can. We have not seen any trials. And one of the reasons we have not seen any trials is because for a felony case, it would have still taken that much time anyway, partly because there's so much evidence. Prosecutors don't think they're going to get all of the generalized evidence to defendants for another couple of weeks. So just because everything that is collected has to be available to defendants or else prosecutors might be on the hook for a Brady violation. So but you wouldn't necessarily see any prosecutions before then anyway, because DOJ has built their felony prosecutions of most people around novel interpretation of obstruction. They basically are saying that the people who walked to the Capitol that day planning to prevent the vote certification or at least delay it, they charged them with obstruction of an official proceeding. And while it's not a crazy application, it is novel. And just in the last 2 weeks, have we seen judges rule in favor of DOJ on that application. And four key judges have done so. And so you really wouldn't see a lot of people plead, a lot of the felons pleading guilty before that, because there was still the possibility that the law that they were being prosecuted under was going to be found inapplicable to what they did. I think we're going to see more people begin to enter into plea deals because of that now.
There was something in the, if my information is correct, over 700 arrests so far for the people who, you know, who entered the Capitol or went there on January 6th. How many have struck deals so far? How many have had a day in court and have taken a deal, or I'm not asking exact numbers, but estimate?
I'm going to say 100.
Okay.
And most of those are trespassers, most but not all. I think we've got seven cooperators. I'd have to count to make sure that number's right. 5, 6, 7, 8 cooperators. We've got about maybe 7 or 8 felony plea deals, and then the rest are going to be trespassers. So, and the trespassing cases, generally, they now that DOJ has it in process, they're generally, you know, they're coming in and they may get arraigned and decide to plead guilty around the same time because DOJ knows what kind of deals they're offering and what they're giving people. So that's going to, you know, the trespassers are going to accelerate soon. The obstruction felony people are going to start accelerating soon. And you're going to be left with the people who are the dead enders who really just want to drag things out and cause as much difficulty for DOJ on the way to their trial. So
Marcy, you have been witnessing these hearings. They're not trials, but they're hearings, by calling into a phone line, right? That's how they're out in the public.
Right. The party, so defense, prosecution, and judge all join on Zoom, and all the court personnel and what have you. But you can call in. So there is a visual proceeding that we can't see as we call in to cover them. But that's how I can do it from Ireland. So as you know, auspiciously, I would not be able to cover these cases that closely if it weren't for that. But I can. And so I see, you know, I think I listened to these hearings for different details than other journalists. So it's not that there aren't other people covering it. Zoe Tillman from BuzzFeed mm-hmm. is doing a tremendous job. Ryan Riley from Huffington Post is doing a really good job there. You know, there are others. I just cover it for, I think one of the things, Nicole, that I have, that I've gotten feedback from people who have better reason to know than I do. I think I have a better grasp on what DOJ has learned about the assault on the Capitol. And that is that contrary to that Reuters report way back in the summer, which was probably meant to be disinformation, there really was a fair amount of cooperation among the leaders of the attack. So people like the Proud Boys. And what they managed to do is launch the first attack from the west side of the Capitol and then launch multiple prongs via different entrances of the Capitol, the most important of which from an evidentiary standpoint is the east front facing the Supreme Court. And the reason that's the most important is because that's where members of the Oath Keepers, members of the Proud Boys who organized the whole thing, and Alex Jones all met at the top of the stairs on the east side of the Capitol before voila, somebody came and opened the door from the inside and they rushed in. And so that is important from an evidentiary standpoint, because Alex Jones lured a bunch, you know, so basically what happened is you've got these people who have a plan, and to accomplish their plan, they need a certain number of bodies. And so they do the initial assault on the Capitol and then kind of hold until Alex Jones has brought all of his mobsters from Trump's speech. And they start attacking from the west side. And then Alex Jones literally says, and one of the things I love about the misdemeanor cases is these are witnesses. Like, they are just trespassers, but some of them are witnesses to key moments. So there's one who, for example, said, you know, we were listening to Alex Jones. I love Alex Jones. This is from the northwest part of the Capitol. So already on restricted grounds. And Alex Jones said, if we came to the east side of the Capitol, Trump would give a second speech. Oh. And there were probably thousands of people there who believed that Trump was going to give a second speech. So they were easily manipulated to move from place to place by saying Trump's going to show up here. And so these trespassers and Alex Jones and Joe Biggs and the stack, which is the famous, that's how the Oath Keepers got in. They all moved to the east steps just before it was open. And, you know, of course, that's important, not just because it shows the coordination between the militia. And, oh, by the way, some members of that militia were hanging out with Roger Stone and checking in regularly that morning of the Oath Keepers. But it's also important because Alex Jones is the one that Donald Trump said, lead this mob to the Capitol. And then Alex Jones, who was in, you know, I've been told was, you know, in communication with Joe Biggs during the day. Alex Jones then decides to move the mob to the east side of the Capitol. And so that shows a remarkable amount of cooperation. And it shows a remarkable amount of cooperation with people who are really just 1 or 2 degrees of separation from Donald Trump. That's where, you know, like, everyone keeps saying Merrick Garland has done nothing, DOJ has done nothing. That's where DOJ is. They got their first Proud Boy cooperator basically the last day before Christmas. They got another really key Proud Boy. They arrested him. He was key to the Western assault and key to moving people to the Eastern side for that assault. So they, you know, DOJ, I think, in early next year, we're going to see a consolidation of the Proud Boy cases, and we're going to see, my guess is, a superseding indictment reflecting cooperation and reflecting what they've learned from these further arrests that lays out what I've just described to you. And that's what DOJ has spent a year doing. It's spent a year not just understanding what happened at the Capitol, but collecting, you know, arresting that trespasser that I just described to you, who is a key witness against Alex Jones, who is a key witness to the fact that before Alex Jones invented this excuse that he was going to go de-escalate the east side of the building, Alex Jones instead moved people to the east side of the building, which was the mob that he purportedly was going to de-escalate. And, oh, by the way, DOJ has already argued that he didn't do so. He went there and he started chanting about 1776. That's where DOJ is at. And that's all visible. That stuff is visible. That's what we know they have already done. And then that's before you get into what, like, so at least two of the Oath Keepers who are cooperating were in touch with Roger Stone in one or another place. What have they told prosecutors about their communications with Roger Stone? Another one was following an Oath Keeper down the hallway as he went to hunt down Nancy Pelosi. What did he tell prosecutors? There are a couple of other cooperators that aren't public or aren't as public, and we don't know what they've told prosecutors yet either, but that's where DOJ is at. And then you've got Jan 6, and they're kind of working from the top down, and they're really not that far apart, Nicole.
Really? So you're not impatient with or frustrated with the DOJ and Merrick Garland's movement on this? You think they're doing it methodically and
well, understand that they are working from the crime scene. Mm-hmm. So they did not sit down on January 7th or on March 12th when Merrick Garland came in, or in April 23rd when Lisa Monaco came in, and say, we know Trump committed a crime, so let's start there. What they did is start with the crime scene and work their way back.
Okay.
And just as an example, you know, a lot of the attention that the January 6th committee is focusing on is what Trump did with Mike Pence, right? Mm-hmm. There's good, like Mike Pence's associates have cooperated with that committee, and they're horrified by what Trump did to Mike Pence. And we're seeing a lot of details come out in the press, and the Willard knew that Pence wasn't going to do what they wanted to do. And John Eastman went to Trump and said, do this. And then Trump went back to the Willard and said this. And, you know, that's where the January 6th committee is getting. But one of the interesting things is in at least three of the cooperating witnesses, they focus on Pence. They focus on, like, the Proud Boy who flipped right before Christmas. His statement of offense is like, the reason we trespassed, he said. And this is not a quote.
Right.
You know, he explained, we intended to disrupt the vote count. And the reason we trespassed, so he never went in the Capitol, but the reason we trespassed is we thought it would be more persuasive or more intimidating to Mike Pence and others who were in the Capitol that day if we were doing it from the Capitol steps than if we were doing it outside the restricted area. So that's the kind of story. And then Gina Bisignano from Southern California, she, you know, she described early, like she described being at the Trump rally and saying, we know Trump is going to betray us. We have to go after Trump. These people, I mean, we know Mike Pence is going to betray. So these people are there's another cooperator who his statement of offense describes walking to the Capitol and learning on the way to the Capitol. And my guess is he learned via a Trump tweet. And my guess is that they have this on GoPro video, but they learned along the way that Trump, that Pence had quote unquote betrayed them. And then as soon as they got to the Capitol, they immediately, you know, the two people he is cooperating against assaulted cops, and by assaulting cops got into the Senate floor.
Right.
So what you're seeing among cooperating witnesses, or at least some of them, is that the targeting of Mike Pence worked. Their understanding of their goal that day was Mike Pence. And so, again, you're not very far. What January 6th committee, what Benny Thompson and Liz Cheney are discovering in their committee work, going from the top down, is really, really, really not that far apart from where DOJ is from the bottom up.
And they're just getting it from different places. So the Proud Boy that you're talking about is Matthew Green, right? And so what was he given a sentence? Do we know what he was charged with? What deal he took?
So the deal that cooperators are getting, when you do a certain amount of damage to a government building, $1,000 is the cutoff. That's a crime in and of itself, but it is one of the crimes that, according to domestic terrorism statutes, can carry a terrorism enhancement. Well, uh-huh. So the deal that DOJ has given to virtually all the cooperators, with one exception that I know of, is we have you on the hook for doing $1,000 of damage to the Capitol. I mean, Gina Bisignano, for people who may not remember, is that salon owner from Southern California.
Okay, now I, yep.
Gucci-er, I forgot what it was, and her eyeliner dripped after she got tear gassed. And she, so that woman broke a window. Like we see the video. She's participating in using some kind of battering ram to break a window. Damn, she's on the hook for that terrorism enhancement. And so she pled guilty back in August, and they took that off the table. And for her, the plea deal isn't actually that nice. And I'll be surprised if she gets through without, you know, violating the terms. But for her, everything else is still on the table, like civil disorder and trespassing and obstruction. So everyone is pleading guilty to that obstruction charge, the one that I said was taking DOJ some time to convince judges. But the oath keepers who plead, Matthew Green, who pled, Matthew Green was named in a conspiracy with Dominic Pizzola, who's that very charismatic guy with the long hair who broke the window with the riot shield.
Right.
Like, you know, sort of. So he was one of the two guys named as a co-conspirator of him. So he was on the hook for the very first broken window of the Capitol. And by pleading guilty, he's off the hook for that now.
Huh.
He's just got, you know, so he's working down from what might have been a terrorism enhancement, so 20 years. He's working down from that to 41 to 51 months. And then if he cooperates, he'll significantly lower that. And you're going to see more people, I think, take that deal in the days ahead. Again, because as judges rule that obstruction is going to hold up, people have less less incentive to hold out. And so you asked, and I think it's really important for me to include this. Do I think, am I impatient with DOJ? No. There are a lot of people out there who are sowing frustration with Merrick Garland. And I promise you, Nicole, not a single one of them has done the homework to understand what DOJ is doing. Like, most of them haven't even figured out what I told you about obstruction until at most recent, like, October. And most of them more recent, most of them are like, wow, Liz Cheney said it's obstruction. What a novel idea. And I'm like, I yelled at you all in August. I mean, how many times have I been on the show?
Right.
Telling
I know.
You that, right.
Yep.
Nicole,
that's why I keep
show.
Asking you. Yep.
And so these people are, I mean, they may be great lawyers, but they are incompetent to talk about what the investigation looks like. They're not talking about, for example, the known investigation into Sidney Powell. They're not talking about the fact that it took until July to prosecute Tom Barak, which is a Mueller referral that was all wrapped up in July of 2020, but it still took 7 months after Merrick Garland came in to prosecute him. And Garland did. Like, Garland didn't back off prosecuting Trump's biggest donor. There's the Rudy Giuliani thing. People have forgotten that in April, like, literally the first big decision that Lisa Monaco did after she became deputy attorney general was to raid Rudy Giuliani.
Right. We remember that. And then, right.
Since that time, they have been doing a privilege review of his phones.
Mm.
And we should in coming days see some debates over whether stuff is actually privileged. That's where we're finally at. I mean, DOJ has gotten some materials from his phones, but like we're going to finally see parts of the debate on that rolling out in the days ahead. But what people don't understand, I think I'm the only one who's written this, is that the scope of time for which DOJ is getting the privilege review is not the scope of the known warrants targeting Rudy Giuliani, which is May of 2018 until December, basically the end of 2019. The scope of time for which they are getting privilege review is January 1, 2018 through the raid, so through April 21st of 2018. Wow. 21, meaning it covers the entire time in which he was helping Trump obstruct Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
And it covers everything he did in the lead up to the coup and the aftermath.
Right.
And so I would at this point be surprised because there's probable cause. I mean, DOJ already had probable cause to get warrants for both of those things. I would be surprised if the stuff that comes out of that privilege review isn't used for both of those. So when people say if they were going after one of Trump's top associates, we would know, ask them. Say, tell me what they're doing with Rudy Giuliani's phone, because unless you know that, then you are not competent to say that they haven't gone after one of his top associates because they're sitting on Rudy Giuliani's phones. And Rudy Giuliani, you know, on top of Roger Stone, I mean, I expect we'll find ties between Flynn or between Sidney Powell and top leaders. You know, the ties between other top people and the rioters are one or two steps removed. But we know Alex Jones was in touch with them. We know that Roger Stone was in touch with them. And we know that Rudy Giuliani was in touch with them because he posted to Twitter this text from somebody who was talking about named rioters. So DOJ is closing. I mean, and the other thing, again, that people don't talk about is DOJ has already... I mean, did you know this, Nicole?
Yeah.
Did you know that DOJ has already arrested two Alex Jones employees?
No, I did not.
Okay. Yeah, they did. They arrested a videographer of his back in the summer. His name is Sam Montoya. And then they arrested Owen Schroyer in August.
Okay.
And so Owen Schroyer is challenging his arrest on First Amendment grounds. And it's actually an interesting debate. The judge in the case took it altogether too seriously, but this will be an interesting test on whether somebody who, as Schroyer did, instigated the crowd, he's not even charged with obstruction. My guess is that he's an interim step to get to Alex Jones, but he's going to be a test of how and whether DOJ can hold somebody like if you can't hold Owen Schroer accountable, you can't hold Alex Jones accountable. And there were extenuating circumstances with Schroer, which made it easier. But and then Montoya's case got delayed sometime. And those delays are always interesting because sometimes means that DOJ found extra evidence that you did something illegal and they're trying to, you know, they're making a deal or what have you. So, yeah, like Alex Jones is literally the Pied Piper of insurrection. He is the one that Donald Trump said, lead this mob to the Capitol. At precisely the time that Alex Jones' former employee, Joe Biggs, was unleashing the attack on the Capitol.
Wow.
This is not that complicated. What you need to know is Joe Biggs, Alex Jones, Donald Trump, those three people, they get you there. The question is, can you get to Alex Jones? And through Alex Jones, can you get to Trump? That's what DOJ has taken a year to do.
I see. And the thing is, what we're hearing are just tiny little drips and drabs. I mean, we know that Roger Stone, for instance, was called by the January 6th commission. He went and pled the fifth and didn't say anything. But we're not hearing what DOJ is doing. There are two separate investigations running basically concurrently, right?
And we should assume that there is a high degree of deconfliction going on, meaning we should assume that before the January 6th committee takes a step, that they go to DOJ and says, can we take a step? We know Mueller did this, for example.
Okay.
And DOJ may say, and may have already said, I mean, The Guardian this morning said that a Rudy Giuliani subpoena is finally coming from January 6th. But DOJ may have said, we don't want you to subpoena Rudy Giuliani until we unveil a warrant against him for January 6th, for example. Okay. Ali Alexander is somebody else who's very interesting. So yes. Ali Alexander, right, he used fronts to get permits for protests at the Capitol, but each of the protests was only authorized for 50 people. And when Alex Jones moved his mob from the west to the east side, he said, we've got a permit over there. Let's go over there. But he didn't go to where they had a permit. They never used the location where they had a permit. Instead, he went to the top of the stairs where the doors were about to be opened.
From the inside.
Yeah. So Alexander, of course, is a key person. Ali Alexander was bragging about it. Ali Alexander has ties to, you know, he was in direct tie to members of Congress, people like Mo Brooks and Paul Gosar. And Ali Alexander, he's another person. I would be shocked if DOJ weren't, for example, investigating him for things like wire fraud. His employees used fronts to get to hide the fact that his organization was the one that was getting multiple. But this is the kind of thing that you can do with subpoenas to banks, right? So Ali Alexander went before the January 6th committee and testified for 7 hours. Interestingly enough, Ali Alexander, for that hearing, went with a guy named Paul Kaminar, who is a lawyer that was very key to Roger Stone's attempts to cover up in the Mueller investigation. So this is a guy that Stone uses for his aides who are trying to cover up something. And so Paul Kaminar, 7 hours. But we know Ali Alexander did exactly the same thing that Roger Stone and Michael Cohen and everyone else who lied to Congress for the Russian investigation did. He released his statement ahead of time.
Right.
He gave it to the New York Times. The New York Times got it or what have you. And his statement made the very same claims that Owen Schroer made. Owen Schroer is the Alex Jones employee who was arrested,
right,
about the excuses they had. Because Ali Alexander was right there with Schroer and Jones, and Alex Jones. So they moved from the west to east, okay? And Ali Alexander was there when Jones said, we've got a permit over there. And as they moved to the east side, Alexander didn't say, hey, our permit's out there where the cops are pointing to us to go to drag the crowd away from the building. That's where our permit is. Instead, Alexander just walked. You know, there's this wonderful moment in a court filing where they have a picture of Schroer, Alex Jones, and Ali Alexander stepping over a do not cross sign to say, you know, I think here's some proof that you knew you were in a restricted zone. And so Ali Alexander told a story that had already been debunked by DOJ, told a story that they were trying to de-escalate the mob when DOJ had already debunked that in an Owen Troyer, filing. So that the outcome of that Owen Troyer challenge will be interesting. There really doesn't seem merit to it, but the judge, you know, this is where you're going to slow down a bit, because you and I don't know Owen Troyer, but he's a frother, right? He's Alex Jones 2.0.
Right.
And so when you arrest somebody who can claim to be a media figure, you want to get your ducks in a row. And so that's where we're at. Ali Alexander did what Roger Stone did that got him prosecuted, which was tell a story that was probably
embellished
to Congress. And I would say Congress knows more this time around than the committees did on the Russian investigation.
Uh-huh.
And I will also say this. I mean, Liz Cheney is a horrible person and has done, you know, like her father may rot in hell.
Yes.
But her father was the best bureaucratic genius of the last half century in D.C., in my opinion. Right. Like when that's why he was so dangerous as vice president, because he knew how to get things done. And he gave that legacy to very few people. David Addington is one. Scooter Libby isn't going to work in government again. But Liz Cheney is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz Cheney is sitting there on the January 6th committee. And this is what I think is delicious about it. Because she's A, she's smart. B, this is her career. Like if this doesn't succeed, she's over.
Right.
Let's see. Her father, remember, in Iran-Contra, did the same thing. He was in the same position she was for a select committee investigating Iran-Contra.
Huh.
And in Iran-Contra, he completely screwed over the DOJ investigation. Like, he was responsible. He gave everyone immunity, and therefore the DOJ investigate, you know, like all these people got off. And so what we're seeing, hopefully, is Liz Cheney implementing the lessons learned from her father and doing the exact opposite. Becoming the perfect foil for DOJ, providing, teeing up stuff for DOJ. So, I mean, just as an example, like, and I don't want to short Benny Thompson on this because he's done a tremendous job.
Right.
They're working very well. But, like, the report that they gave to DOJ for Mark Meadows, the January 6th committee,
uh-huh.
Everyone's like, oh, you know, maybe he'll be held in contempt. It's not about contempt for Mark Meadows. It may be about contempt for Steve Bannon at first. But it's about providing enough evidence that came from voluntarily disclosed records in that report for DOJ to get probable cause to get warrants on Mark Meadows,
mm-hmm.
right? What is happening is that the House investigation has a better claim to get to executive privilege documents. They are going to be viewed less threatening for journalists, for First Amendment, for anybody who's got a First Amendment claim. They've already started going after their colleagues. Mm. They can get beyond the speech and debate protection that DOJ might stumble on further down the road. And so what people, I mean, especially on executive privilege, what happened is in July, Merrick Garland issued his contact order, basically saying from this day forward, you know, Biden will hear nothing about any criminal investigation in DOJ. I mean, he wasn't anyway, but, mm-hmm. you know, he kind of set that line in the sand. And then the next day he said, hey, Joe Biden, can you make a privilege waiver for all of these DOJ people who were part of the coup, for basically Jeffrey Clark?
Right.
And Biden did that. And then shortly thereafter, the January 6th committee made their privilege waiver request to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden waived that. And we're, you know, so the D.C. Circuit has ruled Trump's request to intervene to be bogus. We'll see what the Supreme Court does.
Right.
Again,
so now
that just
made news, I think, on Friday, that Trump now is calling on the Supreme Court to rule on this because he's exhausted every other avenue.
Right.
All that's left is the court.
And then if that fails, and what he's asking is for to hold up the process. Like, he'll still be able to appeal, and the appeal is still going to be meritless, but it's still unlikely to be upheld. But he's asking for the Supreme Court to prevent anything else from happening. And even this Supreme Court, it'll be surprising if they do that. And if they don't, then the House is going to start getting all of these things that Trump tried to prevent them from getting. Mark Meadows's claims, everyone else who is suing, their claims are going to be far weaker. And then if the House finds evidence of crime, if they find evidence, for example, that Mark Meadows, while he was cooperating, was hiding stuff from them, if they find evidence that John Eastman, while he was trying to cooperate, you know, like if they find evidence that Ali Alexander lied to them, then that's going to go right to DOJ. And DOJ will get stuff that has had privilege already waived. Huh. One of the problems Mueller had was Trump kind of waived privilege for the investigation, but then Barr said, well, we don't actually have privilege waivers for anything else. We can't give it to the House. This, we've done the opposite. There's no promise it's going to succeed, but understand that tactically, this is an important thing to have happened. And so while everyone is out there going, oh, nothing's happening, there's been a lot happening. They're just not watching closely enough to notice.
Gotcha. Well, that's why we keep coming to you, Marcy Wheeler. So there is progress being made. Now, let me ask you this. There's a concern, obviously, from those of us out here on the peanut gallery, that the Democrats may lose the House next year. If they do, then this House Select Committee ends.
It goes away.
But the DOJ investigation continues at least through the November, through the election in 2024, right? As long as Biden's in the White House, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect, depending on whether Republicans win one or two houses, I would expect Jim Jordan in charge of whatever committees he's running to, you know, start impeachment and start blah, blah, blah. I am not promising this is going to work.
Right.
This is the thing. Due process takes a lot of time. And again, the people who are ginning up discontent on Twitter are wrong. I mean, they're saying, oh, you know, the coffee boy was already arrested and he was cooperating by this time. That's false. Like, it's still another 2.5 months before we're at the point where the coffee boy pled guilty in the Mueller investigation, in the Russian investigation. And even then, he wasn't cooperating.
Right.
Whereas, you know, at this point, we know of 3 or 4 people who are 1 degree away from who can cooperate against Trump associates who have already flipped. We know of two Alex Jones employees who've already been arrested. We know of other people who were key organizers who've been arrested. And so, but it takes a lot of time. And so I can't promise it's going to work quickly enough. What I can say is it's not for want of trying, and it's not for want of things that are happening that the people who are sowing the discontent actually don't know about.
Right. So let me ask you this, Marcy. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that we should know, if we're not following it as closely as you are, obviously, that we need to know at this point to either make us feel a little better about it, or should scare the shit out, or the shit out of us?
No, I mean, I don't want you to feel better.
All
like,
right.
We're still like, people should not feel good or bad about the investigation. People should say, okay, I'm sufficiently confident that Garland isn't throwing the investigation that I can turn my attention elsewhere. People should focus their time on trying to beat back state level attempts to shut down democracy. People should focus their time. I mean, that's what people, I think your listeners can do. Mm-hmm. Those people sowing discontent on Twitter should spend their time debunking the martyr myth that these January 6th defendants are trying hard to push, because not many people are doing that. I mean, they're claiming that they're being badly treated, and it's false. But that's how white terrorists always get off, by claiming what they've done is heroic. So those are two things, you know, fighting at the local level against attempts to roll back democracy and fighting against the smarter myth. Those are two things that are frankly more important right now than worrying about whether Merrick Garland is doing what needs to be done. But the other thing is that these people, DOJ has arrested 700 people. Of that, about 150 are charged with assault. Over 200 are charged with obstruction. Mm-hmm. Many of the rest are charged with trespassing, but even some of the trespassers are people like Owen Schroyer, who have key information, and virtually all people who are pleading guilty to trespassing are providing DOJ with some kind of cooperation. Like, there's a guy who was sentenced before Christmas, he was the guy who got the cop busted. A cop told him to delete his Facebook.
Right.
And that cop is being prosecuted for obstruction. Well, he's the guy who made that happen. You would never know about him. He's just one of those trespassers, right? But, like, you know, these trespassers are actually providing useful information. But even with the 150 assault people who've been arrested, there are 350 identified assault suspects who are at large. Okay. Wow. There are probably 100 known Proud Boys who were present in some role or another who are at large. There was a guy who was he's accused of being one of the first five people to knock over the first barricade, knock over two cops. One of those cops is still suffering from brain injuries as a result. Okay. So he's one of the first people, and it took them until October to arrest this guy, because it just took time to find him. And he was released because the state, you know, when these January 6ers say, "Oh, I'm being disproportionately treated," that's not actually true. A lot of people who are charged with assault are being released. He was released. And on December 21st, he was arrested drunk off his ass, with an assault rifle and a ton of ammunition in his car.
Oh, my God.
And he had been arrested with two other times on amphetamines. And so, you know, DOJ is pushing for his pretrial detention. But these people, there are people who were part of the attack who are still at large and are dangerous. And that's what people need to worry about. Not that Merrick Garland is not doing everything he can do. It's that the scope of this is really overwhelming, and that's where we're at. It's not a good story, but people should stop worrying about Merrick Garland and start doing other things to try and save democracy.
Please, like, convince Congress to take up voting rights. Also, the 350 or so who you say have been identified but are still out there, have they not been arrested yet because the authorities don't know where to find them? I know in a lot of cases, coworkers, acquaintances, even family members are turning in people who've bragged about their participation. Is it a case of they just don't know where to find these people yet?
It's a combination of things. But yeah, I mean, some people, there are three January 6ers at large. There are one who fled to Belarus, one who is from, like, he's from Florida. His family owns a gun shop. Like a group of his family members conducted this serial assault, and he was the worst exposed, and he's been on the lam since January. There's another guy who was arrested for trespassing and then disappeared since. So there are people on the lam, and some of the people who were there's a higher percentage of felons who were charged with assault than weren't. And so some of them know how to evade arrest, or some of them have more at stake in evading arrest because they have criminal records. Others, DOJ is clearly, and this is true of some of the militia members as well, DOJ, having prevented the first follow-on attack, you know, having arrested enough people in the days after January 6th to prevent, you know, to get us through the inauguration, get us through other events, DOJ, I think, is leaving some people out there for investigative reasons. Like, let's see who else you're talking to. Let's see. I would assume, for example, that there are Proud Boys who were left out there to see how the Proud Boys are reengaging.
Sure.
Same with the Oath Keepers, right? So, right. So there are some arrests that people are very impatient to see, and I assume that some of those arrests are coming. But DOJ has an investigative interest. You know, if all you're interested in is that somebody was in the Capitol, and by the way, you know, a lot of these trespassers, DOJ is obviously arresting them because they took video in the Capitol that is necessary. There were parts of the Capitol like the Oath Keepers walk down a hallway hunting down Nancy Pelosi. There's not good CCTV video that we've seen from there. And so they've arrested, DOJ has arrested a number of people who were there going down the same hallway at the same time with their cameras out filming. Uh-huh. And obviously they arrested them to try and get whatever the Oath Keepers were doing on film. The death scene of the Ashley Babbitt shooting scene, DOJ has been working on figuring out who bears culpability for that scene, who was part of what, they broke a window, terrorism enhancements, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a consolidated case coming out of that. Well, there was CCTV video of that. But the CCTV video doesn't have sound.
Right.
And to the extent that body cameras have sound, they only collect it's directional. They only collect what's in front of you. And so they had to arrest a bunch of the people around there who were filming to find out what their cameras collected as far as sound, to figure out what the various people were doing in that scene. And so, again, when you get really impatient with the trespassers, that's what's going on. Is DOJ is saying, I need to know what conversation happened in that corner of the rotunda. And the way to do that is arrest this guy who was standing right nearby with his camera running.
Sure.
Offices like Merkley's office, Pelosi's office, they're not going to have the same kind of CCTV because they're private spaces. And so, again, they've had to arrest their way to clarity to understand what went on in his offices. We still haven't gotten the main perpetrators for the people who stole both of their laptops.
Wow.
We've gotten related perpetrators in the Pelosi case, but not in the Merkley case. And so that's what goes into this investigation. But those trespassers are easier to get.
Right.
Like if you can see a trespasser who literally just went to the rally and then followed Alex Jones down the road, you don't need to see who paid for his trip. You don't need to see whether he's got ties to Trump people or ties to known militia. You don't need to see what organizing he's been doing in the interim days. And those three questions, who paid for the trip, what ties to the militia, what organizing they've been doing, those are what DOJ, that explains some of the delay to some of the more serious arrests that we've seen in recent days.
Gotcha.
Like that Proud Boy, like the Proud Right. Boy who was key to, he's a key figure like Joe Biggs in the assault on the West and then moving to the East Side and breaking in the East Side, probably even more important than Joe Biggs in pulling it off. He was identified both via Ethan Rodine's phone in January and via researchers, noticed what he had done. So it's been since January that they've been collecting information on him, and they just arrested him back, I think, in November.
Right.
And so who knows what DOJ has learned in the interim period, but that's the kind of delay that we're seeing.
Wow. Marcy Wheeler, I could keep going with you because there's a million questions, but I'll ask you one more. Do you see this eventually leading to Donald Trump? Do you think there will ever be charges brought against him? Because everything I hear, it all leads to Donald Trump.
I think that the obstruction charge that DOJ has been using from day one.
Mm-hmm.
I did a piece back in October. So if you want to link it, I'll send it to you.
Okay,
you can link
that'd
it.
Be great.
It's the one where I told the TV lawyers to shut up and start looking at obstruction. And that's what I linked back to when Liz Cheney was like, obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Did Trump obstruct by inaction or action? And viewers can see that the way in which DOJ has laid out this conspiracy, Trump has already done a lot of the things that the Proud Boys have done and the Oath Keepers have done, including getting lots of bodies to DC.
Right.
I think that what he did with Mike Pence obviously targeted Mike Pence. And I think that both DOJ and the January 6th committee are developing evidence that he knew he was making illegal requests of Mike Pence. The lawyer for DOJ that has been doing the kind of brain work for all of this stuff said, I think back in November, he said, he was asked by Carl Nichols, who's the judge who's presiding over Steve Bannon's case. He's a Trump appointee, but he's taking these cases very seriously.
Good.
So this guy, Carl Nichols, asked this guy, James Pierce, DOJ lawyer, he said, well, could this basically, he didn't say, could this apply to the president? But he asked, could this apply to the president? And Pierce said at first, well, no. And he said, but if the president or if the person in question asked the vice president to do something he knew to be illegal, then yes, it could. Uh-huh. So the way DOJ is approaching it is if you knowingly broke the law while you were trying to obstruct the vote count, then yes, you can be held accountable. And again, that I didn't cover that one. That was Josh Gerstein. But that moment was DOJ going on the record saying, here's what it would take for us to charge Trump under the same rubric that we've charged everyone else. There are questions like, could you put in the call to Brad Raffensperger? Clearly illegal, clearly innocent. Right. Could you say that that was part of the big lie leading up to January 6th? I think so. This is an area where Devin Nunes has been very impatient, not seeing DOJ prosecute it. My guess is that DOJ... I mean, look, the other thing people should know is the DOJ is unbelievably... under resource, like this is so many people. DOJ is taxed. The public defenders and the CJA appointees are taxed. The courts are taxed. Mm-hmm. This is so overwhelming, and so it is reasonable for DOJ to say, so long as Georgia has an ongoing grand jury investigation that we can take confidence in going on into that call, and they do. Then that is, they can share with us. Oh. They can share information with us. So they can develop that part of the investigation. We can develop working from the ground up. January 6th can work from the top down. We have, you know, we're liberating all of Rudy Giuliani's purported privileged communications. And I don't think Tom Barak was prosecuted off of a Mueller referral. Michael Cohen seems to believe there's stuff in the works, and he may know. Yeah. By the way, Rudy Giuliani's obstruction, the most obvious case where Rudy Giuliani was involved in Trump's obstruction, where he wasn't serving as Trump's lawyer yet, involved Michael Cohen and used his phone.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
And used his phone. So it is possible that evidence from Rudy Giuliani's phone made that obstruction charge easier and stronger. And there's at least one other case where there's an investigation that was a referral from Mueller that I know was renewed in recent months. And so, is Trump beyond limits? I don't know. You know, like they're going to go where they get the evidence.
Sure.
And the bar for prosecuting a former president is going to be very high. But that August post that I did lays out very clearly, here's how the conspiracy that they've set up. And what it is, Nicole, really, is it's interlocking conspiracies, right? The mm-hmm. Oath Keepers are charged by themselves. But they coordinated with Joe Biden, who coordinated with Alex Jones,
right?
Who was sent there by Donald Trump. I mean, this is what you need to know. Those are the five players, right? They all coordinated. And so the way conspiracies work is, Jessica Watkins doesn't need to know Ethan Nordine or Donald Trump to be in a conspiracy with them. They all need to have agreed on a common goal and taken steps on that common goal. And so really what DOJ has been doing is this network of conspiracies that if they get the evidence, and I'm not promising they will get there, but if they get the evidence, they can plunk at least Donald Trump's close associates into. And who knows, maybe Donald Trump.
Wow, there's so much there. And there's so much more that we haven't even touched on, totally apart and separate from January 6th, are the charges that New York State is investigating Trump for. I mean, there's other stuff out there. We were just talking about, really, the events around January 6th and the prosecutions around that. Marcy Wheeler, I can't recommend emptywheel.net highly enough. I do it all the time. If you want to be informed on all of this, what the DOJ is doing and how this January 6th committee works, and emptywheel.net. You're doing such a great job over there. Thank you so much for staying on top of it, and thank you for spending so much time with us today. I know I'm infringing on your holiday. I can't thank you enough.
Thanks, Nicole. Good to talk to you.
Marcy Wheeler, again, she is in Ireland, living there now. Can't blame her. Okay. I've got to run because I'm doing Brad Friedman's broadcast tonight. But there was breaking news while that interview was running. Ghislaine Maxwell, found guilty on 5 of 6 counts. The only one she wasn't convicted on was coercing a minor under the age of 17. And I don't know the specifics because I didn't follow the case that closely, but 5 out of 6, she's going to jail for a long time. Maybe she'll meet her old pal, Jeffrey Epstein, where she's headed. All right. Until tomorrow, Howie Klein will be here. It's Thursday. We're going to have a candidate on with us. It's business as usual. All right. I'll see you then. Thank you for listening, everyone. Gotta run. Bye.